And then, more interestingly, we'll look at two new topics. One is imaginary Gaussian integrals. And the other one is Gaussian integrals with Grassmann variables. So I know that in Anna's class you've already talked about Grassmann variables. I'll rely on that, and if anybody has any questions later on, feel free to ask. Okay, so let me first remind you that yesterday we ended by considering averages with Gaussian weight. So we had this expression, xk1 up to xkm was equal to some normalization times integral and product of I going from 1 to n dxi xk1 xkm exponential minus 1/2 x I a I j x j, and the normalization n was equal to 1 over I of a 0. So that's equal to square root of determinant of A divided by 2 pi raised to power n over 2. And then we considered two examples when we have two axes and when we have four axes. So okay, let me remind you that we found that x l x k, the average, is equal to just the inverse of this matrix A, k l. And we also saw that the average of four axes factorizes into products of pairs. So x from k1 to k4 was the last thing we did yesterday. So this is equal to average of x4, x3 times average of x2, x1 plus average of x4, x2 plus times average of x3, x1. Oh, this board doesn't go up. Sorry, didn't realize that. But anyhow, you have this from yesterday. I'll hide it in a moment. Okay, finally, x4, x1. X3, X2. So anyhow, the main point here is that these are all possible combinations of the indices. So Like I said, sorry that I'll hide it, but you should have this. You have a question about this?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was trying to get a sort of feel for why the average of the products should relate to the inverse of A. You know, I'm thinking of A because of the one-dimensional Gaussian case is basically telling the characteristic weight of the Gaussian. And since the inverse here is KL, it's suggesting the overlap between the K and the L variables. So that's, that sort of makes sense. But why the A inverse in terms of significance of why should that, why should A inverse play this role in the average of the product?
I don't know what to say except that we derived it, right? We computed the formula. So other than that, one can motivate it in whatever way one wants, but I mean, that was a computation.
Yeah, just sometimes there's a math explanation and a physical explanation. I was wondering if there was a physical sense.
Well, I don't know. All I can say is that in general, in physics, there are various other examples. So the weighting factor doesn't have to be a Gaussian. And so in each case, it depends what physical system you're considering. And then you can give some physical interpretation of this and that. Here, we are studying Gaussian integrals. So this is the easiest weight factor to consider. But I mean, this notion of averaging is much broader than that. And again, it depends on the physical context. So in various cases, it's various different things. In quantum field theory, this could be some kind of a two-point correlator or whatever. So, and actually, yeah, in quantum field theory, you can relate that to the Green's function. So it depends on the context. I don't think that I can just say anything other than we compute it. Okay. So actually, I don't want to spend too much time with that. But let me also mention that, as was pointed yesterday, if we have odd number of x's, so when we have odd number, then the average vanishes. Let's say x2 k2m plus 1. And this could be understood easily if you remember that we were computing everything by differentiating with respect to B, an expression that was exponential of 1/2 B I A inverse IJ BJ. So we were differentiating, so we were using that X K. Okay, it can be obtained by differentiating with respect to bk, and then taking all b's equal to 0. So when one considers such a product with odd number, there will always be some b multiplying the exponential. So once you substitute all components of the vector b to 0, this just vanishes identically. You can check it, say, for the case of 1 or 3 or something simple. So I'm not going to check this explicitly. But let me state the generic case for even number. And that will be the Weak's theorem in this context. So for even number, and this is the straightforward generalization of the case with four axes that we considered yesterday. So for even number, we have average of x k1 up to some x km, where now this is even. We can write it as just 2m, say, to signify that it's even, but OK, it doesn't matter. So this is sum over all possible pairings. And then we have A inverse K, let's say L1, K, L2, up to A inverse K, L, M minus 1, K, LN. So remember that each A inverse was one pairing. That would be the xk L1 and xk L2, and so on. So just like, let me again show this. Just like this case of four axes, we had all possible pairings. And this generalizes for any even number. In exactly the same way that we computed yesterday. It's just more tedious. So this statement is called Weak's theorem. And more broadly, Weak's theorem is just about factorizing products of some number of quantities into sums of products of pairs. So in the context of quantum field theory, you're actually going to see a version of this that is related to products of creation in annihilation operators of quantum fields and how they can be written as sums of just pairings. But in this context, this is the version. So I think that's all about this that I want to say.
I think the last class we found the switch indices in the inverse matrix. I think we had inverse.
But remember that A was actually symmetric matrix, so A inverse is also symmetric. There I was keeping the order so that it's clear what came from what differentiation, but anyhow, A was a symmetric, real symmetric matrix. And later today, we'll actually be considering matrices that are Hermitian. So it's probably useful to remind what we had before. So now let's start considering imaginary Gaussian integrals. So the simplest case is an integral that is very similar to what we studied yesterday, but imaginary. So integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of e to power I a x squared over 2 dx, where again a will be positive. Actually, later on we'll comment on a negative, so this is not crucial here, but for the moment it's a well, we have to choose one of the two options in order to compute the integral. If we chose now a negative, we still will be able to compute it, but we have to choose a different contour compared to what I'll do now. So I'll comment later on a negative. So the most efficient way to compute this integral is actually to analytically continue to the complex plane. So we're going to substitute instead of x some complex variable. And so now we'll consider the integral, let's call it I hat, which is integral of e to I a z squared over 2 dz, where since this is now a complex integral, we need to choose a contour in the complex z plane. So so that's where the difference comes. If I took a negative here, I would have to choose a different contour compared to the one that will be suitable for this case. So let us choose a contour. Now, at first, this contour will seem kind of weird, but as we go along with the computation, you'll start understanding why it was a suitable choice. I mean, in principle, one can make various choices, but the one that I'll take is very convenient for this particular computation. So in the complex z-plane, let's take the following this the complex z-plane. So, well, let's take a segment of the real axis, say from some minus r to plus r. And now let's choose, well, let's take an angle that is pi over 4 and take, okay, let me first draw the contour and then I'll explain. This may not be a perfect picture, but this and that are just segments of a circle with radius r. So, okay, so on the real axis, we have an interval from minus r to r. Let's call that C1. Then we have C2 is a circular segment here. Then C3 is just this line, which is subtends angle pi over 4 with the real axis. And finally, we have the last piece, C4, which is another circular segment here. So we choose the contour. C, such that it's the sum of those. Right? So C1 is, again, part of the real axis from minus r to r. C2 is part of this circle. C3 is then this line. And C4 is, again, a circular segment. So now let's consider this integral on each of those four pieces. And in fact, we can see immediately that on C1, if we take the limit of r going to infinity, we recover exactly the integral that we want to compute. So that's part of the motivation. That's why we chose C1 like this. So on C1, we can see that the limit as r goes to infinity of the integral becomes exactly the integral that we want to compute. So to find this integral, we need to compute I hat on those three contours and see what we get. That will then equal minus this result will be equal to our integral. So any questions so far? Like I said, at this point, it may seem kind of mysterious why we chose such a convoluted contour. But as we start considering each of those pieces separately, you'll see how easy things become. And that will be ultimately the motivation for this choice. Yeah?
Just a quick question about the Wicks theorem. So is it some over pairs of A inverse? Because there's three dots in between the two A's. So it seems like it's some over N.
These are not pairs, right? Depending on how large M is, there could be because, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, but when we had 4, and when we had M4 last time.
No, but see, when m is equal to 2, you have only one A inverse. When m is equal to 4, you have two A inverses.
Yeah, so when it seems to suggest that there's four of them, like m, because it starts at L1 and it ends at Lm, right? Or Lm
but minus. M is not specified here, right? M can be anything. So for example, if you have six axes, then you would have three A inverses. Right? The number of A inverses is one of the number of axes.
Oh, because it will continue at L3. Oh, okay.
So.
Okay. I see.
Yeah, because you pair.
Yeah, okay. I didn't
so, yeah, the number of pairs is one half of the number of all. Yes. And then you just sum all possible permutations of the indices. Okay, any question about the contour? So let's consider then the next piece, which is what happens on the part that is C2. So on C2, we can write the variable z as r times e to I theta. So it's just a phase because C2 is a part of a circle with radius r. So this is also equal to r. So this is the generic form of this variable where theta is in the interval 0, pi over 4. Probably I should have mentioned that, I forgot to mention that. So an important point is that inside this contour, there is no pole of the integrand. So that's why when we integrate I hat over such a closed contour, we are going to get 0. The integrand of I hat. So that's why we can compute the integral over C1 by computing the rest, and then just minus this result is going to give us our integral. Right? This is a generic result from complex analysis. Anytime you integrate a complex function along a contour that does not encircle any pole, the total result is just 0. So now back to here on C2, then we have limit of R going to infinity, integral over C2. And the integrand is now exponential. And I just substitute this form of z into this integrand. So this is I a over 2 r squared. And here I write e to I theta as cosine plus I sine. So it becomes cosine 2 theta plus I sine 2 theta. So the point of writing it this way is so that one can see explicitly that here we have one I and here another I. So this is going to become minus some real number. So we are left with limit as r goes to infinity, integral over C2 e I a over 2 r squared cosine 2 theta times e to power minus. This minus is from I times I a over 2 r squared sine 2 theta. Now we can notice that since theta goes from 0 to pi over 4, this 2 theta goes from 0 to pi over 2. So this sine of 2 theta is positive. So that's one motivation to choose this contour. At this point, it's still not completely clear because we could have taken pi over 2, and then this would be from 0 to pi and still would be positive. But we'll see later on for another contour why it was important to take pi over 4. So anyhow, that's already part of the motivation for the contour. We see that this is positive. So we have e to some power minus of a positive quantity. So in the limit of r going to infinity, this goes to 0. Right? Because we have some oscillating quantity that multiplies something that vanishes in that limit. So the limit is 0. So similarly, on C3, we also get that the limit is 0. So not Oh, sorry, not C3, C4. That's the other. C4 is, yeah, the other circular. Exactly. So on C4, the other circular segment, we also get zero. I'm not going to write, it's kind of the same thing. So the only non-trivial contribution is going to come from this part, C3, from this line that is with angle pi over 4 with respect to the real axis. And now it will become actually important to see why we chose pi over 4. Now things are going to simplify with this choice. So on C3, now on C3 we have a fixed angle, right? That's pi over 4, but the radial distance changes as we move along this contour. So the complex variable z now can be written as, let's say, some small r, which now is a variable, times e to I pi over 4. Now this is a variable. Right? Before capital R was a constant, now this small r is a variable. So then we have the integral, the limit when r goes to infinity of the integral on C3 of e to I a z squared over 2 dz. Now this becomes equal to, so now let's just substitute this expression for z here. Well, first of all, we also have to substitute in dz. So we get minus infinity, integral from minus infinity to plus infinity dr I should probably point out that the overall minus is because we're going in this direction, right? Because we want a closed contour, so we have to follow the arrows. So because we go from here to here, it's minus. From here to here would have been plus, right? So the overall minus is just due to the direction of our contour. So dr e to I pi over 4 times e to I a over 2 r squared e to I pi over 2. So this came from the square of this. And now we can see the main simplification, why we chose the angle pi over 2, because this is a very easy thing to write. So this is just I. And similarly, well, this is also kind of easy, but so anyhow, the choice on the contour was such that everything becomes easy to compute. So we have minus square root of I times integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, dr e to minus a r squared over 2. Right? So this minus came from I times I. And this now is something that we already know. So this is minus, and together with this, it becomes square root of 2 pi I over A. Right? So this is the integral that we already considered yesterday in the beginning. So then, remembering this theorem from complex analysis that when you integrate a function along a closed contour and the function does not have any pole inside the contour, the total answer is zero, then we see that the part along C1 that gave our integral has to be equal to this. So let me write this entirely, because it's an important formula. So the integral that we wanted to compute from minus infinity to infinity of e to power I a x squared over 2 dx is equal, and because this is a sum over all the contours, right, over C1, C2, C3, plus C4. So, and this gives our integral, whereas this is the quantity we computed there. So our integral is minus that, right? So our integral is minus what we got here from C3. So that minus drops out, and we're just left with 2 pi I over A. So this is the main outcome for the simplest imaginary Gaussian integral. And I think there was already something like that yesterday in the tutorial, and some people were wondering about the I. So indeed, one can notice that this is related to what we had before just by a rescaling of this kind when we had the real case. So sometimes when things look very simple to the eye, they just turn out to be simple. Although in this case, we need to go along all this contour, but we ended up with an expression that we could have obtained from the real answer just by a simple substitution. Only before, we could not have been sure that it's legitimate to do a substitution, whereas now we see that it is, that it gives the sensible answer. So, and let's now generalize also this for the case that is the complex, the imaginary analog of what we had yesterday with a matrix and a vector. Okay, so similarly, one can find that the following integral, where again, as yesterday, A is a matrix and B is a vector, again, real symmetric. The integral that looks like this integral of product from 1 to n dxi exponential of I over 2 x k a k l x l plus b l x l. This is equal to 2 pi I raised to n over 2 divided by square root of determinant of A times exponential of I over 2 bk A inverse kl bl. And again, this is related to what we had yesterday, just by rescaling with I, with imaginary I. Okay, any questions so far? So I'm, after this, going to turn to Grassmann variables. So, yeah?
So the previous result for the one variable case, so the same formula true for negative A.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to comment on that. So indeed, if you have A negative, the difference is that one has to choose a different contour so that the integrals are converging. So yeah, that's a good question, actually. Let's see whether anybody can tell me what kind of contour would be suitable for A negative. It's quite similar to this one, just a little bit different.
You just rotate it?
Yeah, indeed. So you just have to rotate it up so that, well, this line has to become like this. And then the contour will be kind of, let's say, reflected along the real axis. Just so, indeed, so for negative A, different contour. Okay, so now the third topic for today, Gaussian integrals with Grassmann variables. So we'll have now a set of Grassmann variables, say theta I and theta bar I, where I goes, say, from 1 to n. And you have been reminded in Anna's lectures, but let me just briefly say again. So Grassmann variables means that they anti-commute. For I different from j, and the square of each one is equal to 0. And well, if these are not real but complex, then the complex and the complex conjugate can be viewed as independent variables, just like you can view the complex variable z and its conjugate z bar as two independent variables instead of viewing them as two real independent variables. So, and the other important property is that integral over a Grassmann variable is by definition considered to be the derivative. So if you have some function integral, this integral is defined to be df d theta. So in particular, if the function does not depend on theta, this integral is identically 0. And if it's just theta, if the function is just equal to theta, this is 1. So if you have any other questions later on, we can discuss. But these are the basic properties that you need about Grassmann variables. It should be enough. So now let's turn to some integrals with Grassmann variables. So, okay, since this is here, to comment about the earlier question, I guess maybe it's clear now. So if you have six, then there are going to be three different A inverses so that you can distribute the six indices on them, right? And then you just sum over the different permutations And if you have 8, then there are going to be 4 A inverses, and so on. So again, the number of A inverses is 1/2 of the number of X's in the average. So let's consider the following integral. So it's a first example. Let's consider integral product I from 1 to n d. So now we have complex variables, complex Grassmann variables theta, and also their conjugates theta bar. And we view them as independent. So theta I bar d theta I times exponential of minus sum j from 1 to n lambda j theta bar j theta j. Board wasn't so stable yesterday. Anyhow, so. Yeah?
Would you mind repeating what you said about complex Grassmann variables when you were writing on that middle board?
So, well, maybe what I should say is that, so the analogy is like, say if you have two real numbers, x plus y, you can write a complex number as x plus iy, right? And you can write z bar as x minus iy. Now, you have two variables, but you can either say that the two variables are x and y, or you can say that the two variables are z and z bar. So although z bar is, strictly speaking, complex conjugate of z, you can view those as independent variables. So you think of this as just doing a change of variables from x, y to z, z bar. So similarly, in this case, I'm going to have two complex Grassmann variables theta and theta bar, and I'm going to view them as independent, because each of them can be written as containing two real Grassmann variables, and so I'm doing the change of variables from the two real to the complex and the complex conjugate. So theta and theta bar are independent.
Operation defined between theta and theta bar? Like, is there any?
What do you mean operation?
Like, theta I, theta j, is minus theta j, theta I, right? So what is theta I, theta I, like j bar, for example? Does it follow that, or is?
Yeah, all of them anti-commute.
Okay.
Well, you can just think of that. Like, OK, so instead of numbers, if you say that this is theta 1, and well, now let's say that theta is theta 1 plus I theta 2. So theta 1 and theta 2 are real Grassmann variables. Theta bar is theta 1 minus I theta 2. And you can deduce the commutation relations from those. So theta 1 squared is 0, theta 2 squared is 0, theta 1 theta 2 is equal to minus theta 2 theta 1. And from that, you can compute. So OK, maybe I should also mention that people usually introduce, that's a convention, but usually introduce a factor of 1/2 or square root of 2 just to normalize. But this is really a convention. Again, it doesn't matter. You can just absorb any real number into the definitions of theta 1 and theta 2. But I think maybe you had some normalization factor when Anna was writing things, right? So let's get back to this integral. So we can write, so this exponential, we can just write as a product of exponentials. So we have integral from, well, integral over I from 1 to n d theta I bar d theta I product over j, again, from 1 to n, e to minus lambda j theta j bar theta j. Right, so this is just writing this as a product of exponentials, since each of those terms in the sum is independent. So now we can expand each exponential. So we have here, we can Taylor expand each exponential, d theta I bar d theta I. Again, I always goes from 1 to n. Let me just not write this for brevity. And product j 1 minus lambda j theta bar j theta j. Oh, okay, that's a good question. Can anybody answer that? Yeah, that's because theta squared is zero, right? So when you expand each of those exponentials, you only have the zeroth order term is one, and then the first order term is this one. The next order term is going to have theta with the same index j squared and theta bar with the same index squared. So because of this property, this is an exact equality. So if these were commuting variables like the axis we had before, it would be an approximation to write like that, just for some small parameter. But in the case of Grassmann variables, it's an exact equality. So here, well, first of all, we can see that the first term doesn't depend on any theta, so it's just going to vanish in the integral, because integration with respect to Grassmann variable, like I mentioned, is the same as differentiation. So there won't be anything from one. And so the only contribution will be from the second term. And in fact, the minus will disappear because we need to interchange the order of theta and theta bar in order to differentiate further with respect to theta and then with respect to theta bar. So, well, we're just going to get product I from 1 to n of lambda I. Right? Because there are exactly the same number of thetas in the measure and in this integrand. So each d theta gets its own theta here and gives 1. And we're just left with the remaining prefactor. So OK, let's also write this. I should have maybe said that in the beginning. But let's view lambda I as the eigenvalues of a diagonal matrix, so that it's easier to generalize. So this is a crucial difference from the case of the commuting variable x. If you remember, before we were getting always 1 over square root of determinant, whereas now we get just the determinant. So now let's generalize by considering this kind of integral, but instead of just these diagonal values, here we're going to have a matrix that now we're going to first take non-diagonal and diagonalize it.
So
yeah?
Where did the minus go when you wrote its product is lambda I?
So because theta bar j times theta j is equal to minus theta j theta bar j. So right, in each product, there is a minus like that. And so in each product, you anti-commute them, and the minus disappears from everywhere in each term. So OK, so here we started I should have written probably A, but we started immediately with the diagonal matrix. So now let's generalize this to the case when A is not diagonal. And we're going to diagonalize it. Oh, let's go here. And okay, we need to hurry a bit, so let's just look at the generalization of the integral that we considered yesterday with real variables, with a commuting variable x, which depended on a matrix and on a vector. So now the generalization to the present case, that's going to be example two, is the following integral, which depends on a matrix A and some complex vector. So let's write explicitly B and B bar to stress that it's complex. So this is a matrix. And unlike yesterday, since now we're looking at complex numbers, this is going to be a Hermitian matrix. And this is a complex vector. So let me also remind you that yesterday we pointed out that the real symmetric matrix was diagonalizable via orthogonal matrix. Now, in the case of Hermitian matrix, we're going to need a unitary matrix to diagonalize it. So we'll get to that, but let me first write the integral. So that's integral over, the measure is again pi, I goes from 1 to n, d theta bar I, d theta I, exponential minus theta bar I a I j theta j plus. Now, since B is a complex vector, we are going to have a slightly more complicated term, namely B bar I theta I plus B I theta bar I. So if somebody is wondering why are we considering things like that, this will be very important, actually, in quantum field theory. In particular, in order to describe fermionic particles, like protons, neutrons, the particles that make up matter, you need such anti-commuting variables. So you're going to have integrals like that in the path integral when you get there. So that's what is the inspiration for this particular form, not just because we want to play with things. So OK, so we want to follow the same, or will follow the same strategy as for the bosonic or commuting case from yesterday. Again, the commuting case is called often bosonic just because this is the case of bosonic particles in quantum field theory, like photons, say. Whereas this is called fermionic case usually because the anti-commuting variables are essential to describe fermions in nature. So we will follow same procedure as yesterday. So it's the same procedure as for the bosonic case. And let me briefly remind you that in that case, so you can find this in your notes, but in that case, an important point was that we introduced, so there we had the variables xi instead of theta I, and we introduced a change of variables to yi plus x bar I, where x bar were given by A inverse ij, bj. So for the same reasons as yesterday, we're going to do the same kind of thing here, but slightly briefly. So that's why I'm reminding it so that I don't go through the same motivation. I'll just write what we do. actually. In principle, I can go 15 minutes more, right? So should be able to make it. So that was yesterday. Now, following the same logic, we introduce new variables in the following way. So we write our variables theta I as a new variable eta I plus A inverse ij bj. Right, so eta I is the analog of yi. That's the new variable. And similarly, we can write for theta bar I, eta bar I plus A inverse ji bj bar. Now, can anyone tell me why I didn't put any bar on the matrix A? Exactly. So remember, it's a Hermitian matrix. So that's why this is what we get when we complex conjugate this initial expression. So yeah, just in case somebody doesn't remember, Hermitian means that Aij is equal to A bar Ji. So we introduce these new variables, and now we can rewrite the expression in the exponential there. So let's rewrite the three terms one by one. So minus theta bar I A I j theta j is going to be minus eta bar I plus. First, I'm just going to substitute the thetas, so that's a little bit tedious, but I want to have it explicitly. Ki bk bar a ij eta j plus a inverse jl BL. Now we start writing this out. And so there is one obvious term, eta bar I, A ij eta j. Then, so for example, when we take this term, we see that A and A inverse are going to just give delta, right? So we have eta bar I. And from here, we have, because this is the inverse matrix multiplied by the matrix, so we just have delta I L B L. So then we have also minus B bar k, and I'm not going to, well, okay, let me write one more delta just in case. Delta kj. And finally, people see here, finally there is b bar k a inverse kl bl. The next term, b bar I theta I, that's easy. It's just b bar I eta I plus b bar I a inverse ij bj. And let me also write the last one explicitly, because I want to point out what terms cancel in the sum of all those three terms. So this is bi eta bar I plus bi A inverse ji bj bar. So these are all three terms that enter into the exponential. And there we see we have to add all of them, right? So we have to add all these three terms. So we can see that some things cancel. So for example, this here, when we use the delta function, this is just minus eta bar I bi. So and this is the same eta bar as this one, right? So in the sum, this and this are going to cancel. Similarly, this should cancel with something. This will cancel with this. And also, these terms are going to add up. This and those. Right? Because it's just a matter of relabeling the indices. They're the same kinds of terms. So we have minus and then plus plus. So the total will be just 1 plus of this term. So what we get in the exponential, finally, is the following. Let me write this way. So adding all those three terms, we find that the integral on top becomes a I of a b b bar is equal to integral the product I from 1 to n d eta I bar d eta I exponential minus eta bar I a I j eta j plus b bar I a inverse I j b j. And well, we see that the integration measure d theta bar d theta is just equal to d eta bar d eta because of this transformation. The rest is constants there, right? So there is no difference here. And this just came from summing the three terms. So any questions so far? Yeah?
I'm just wondering, when we define two new variables, don't we in principle have to prove that they're Grassmann variables?
Well, they are Grassmann because they're equal to Grassmann variables. Right, we define them to be equal to Grassmann variables.
You'd have to impose some sort of condition on eta, wouldn't you?
Can't you just say that the linear combination of any Grassmann variable is still a Grassmann variable?
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, the sum and product and anything. So this is or if you have a real number plus a Grassmann variable, that's still a Grassmann variable. Anytime you have an expression that is some kind of a linear combination of Grassmann variables, you still have a Grassmann variable. So OK, so this part is a constant now, so we can take it in front of the integral. So we're left with exponential b bar I a inverse ij bj, and then integral. And OK, since I don't have much time, I'm going to do here another transformation, and I'll explain it in a moment. OK, well, now let me first just rewrite the integral that we have there. So. Okay, so we have this integral, which looks very much like what we had in the previous commuting case. And now this is the place where we want to diagonalize A. So since A is Hermitian, it means that there exists some unitary matrix U. Such that U inverse, what is that? I hope they are not going to cut us. So U inverse A U is some diagonal expression, let's say lambda 1, lambda n, and again everything 0 outside of the diagonal. So okay, we are going to finish this. Okay, so remember before we introduced new variables that were just given with the orthogonal matrix acting on the old variables. So now we introduce again new variables. In order to diagonalize. So we write the variables eta I that we had as uij times eta tilde j. And these are the elements of the unitary matrix. The same unitary matrix that diagonalizes A from here. So then we can write the integral. So then the integral becomes, in terms of the variable theta tilde, again, it's very similar to what we had before. Before, we just had here the orthogonal matrix with the commuting analogs of those. You can just look at the notes from yesterday. So this becomes exponential bi bar a inverse. We'll finish shortly, so don't lose hope. Bj times the integral, and there is a Jacobian for the transformation here, and then product over I from 1 to n d eta tilde bar I d eta tilde I exponential minus. So, well, let me just mention this here so that I can write there the answer. So we can insert here a U inverse. And also here, U and U inverse. And U inverse times eta is going to give eta tilde. And U inverse A, U is going to be the diagonal. So this can be written as eta tilde bar K I don't know how it tells. Okay, let me at least try this explicitly. U inverse K L A ln u, say, mn times eta tilde n. And this is just equal to lambda k delta kn. So the total expression, well, let me write this whole total expression, then just becomes minus lambda k eta tilde k bar eta tilde k. So the only other thing that we need to take care of is this Jacobian. And yesterday I was writing it more explicitly, but today let me just write directly that it's determinant u times determinant u inverse. And so again, it's equal to 1. And each of those pieces came. So for example, when we write the product over eta tilde I in terms of maybe it was the other way around. Sorry, anyhow. Determinant u, it's probably the other way. And for the bar, we get u inverse. So that's why we have a product of two. Yesterday, we just had one determinant of the orthogonal matrix because we had just one set of real variables. But now we have two. So this is going to be determinant u inverse with a bar tilde. So yeah, you can convince yourselves that these are true, just like yesterday we saw that when we did that kind of change of variable with the orthogonal matrix, we were getting a Jacobian that was determinant of the orthogonal matrix. So this is the reason for this Jacobian. So taking everything together, we see that this integral becomes equal to exponential b bar I a I j a inverse I j b j. And here again we have a product. So this is the kind of integral that we computed in the first part of the Grassmann integral part of this lecture. So this is just the product of lambda k, which is the determinant. So again, let me just write it here because I don't have much time. So this is just the determinant of the matrix A. And this is the important outcome that will be needed later and is important in quantum field theory. So the main difference again with the bosonic case was that before we were getting a multiplier like this, but the dependence on the determinant of A was 1 divided by the square root of the determinant. Whereas for the fermionic case, for the anti-commuting variables, we get determinant of A in the numerator. So that's the key difference with the previous case. So, okay, any questions about this? Yeah?
So the last result, the exponential, can again be written as a simpler thing, right? Because there are Grassmann numbers or not?
No, here there is no more Grassmann anything, right? These are just
the B.
Hermitian matrix and the complex vector B.
Oh, yeah.
Right? We finished.
B is not a Grassmann. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we integrated out all the Grassmann variables. Well, I'm not sure. Yeah, so you can derive also the analog in the fermionic case, but again, yeah, you have to be careful whether you have averages only of the thetas or theta bars, or you have both of them. And again, you can reduce to just averages of pairs. V is a complex vector, right?
Yeah. V is a fact. So when you do that, the change of variable, so how you can make sure that eta I is not a
variable? It's because theta I is a Grassmann variable, right?
Yeah, but minus a.
But okay, but if you have a Grassmann variable plus the number 2, say, this is still a Grassmann variable, right? 3 times a Grassmann variable plus 2 is also a Grassmann variable. You can do any kind of linear combinations of Grassmann variables. These are still Grassmann variables, plus 6 or whatever. These are still a Grassmann variable.
But the number just 1 isn't a Grassmann variable. If you square, you get 1.
Yeah.
Well, okay, they are not going to always have canonical normalization, but. So you have to start with the canonically normalized and then derive every other quantity how it's normalized.
But in say eta I squared, if it's a Grassmann variable, it should be 0. But here, you calculate it, they get a non-zero number. It's not a normalization. So if it's 1, I can normalize it to make it 1. But for Grassmann variable, we need it to be 0. But you minus something, then you calculate the square, it's not 0.
Okay, I think I see your point. So this should be a vector of Grassmann variables. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
If that's the case, I think you need a minus sign as well for when you get these conditions in the output.
Yeah.
So
V is
which sign? Which sign? Somebody was saying that. There should be a minus somewhere.
Well, I'm not sure if there should be a vector for us in variables.
Yeah, I have to think more about this, but okay, let me get back to this tomorrow. Yeah?
When you added up those three terms and then put them back in, did you put in the wrong one? Because it looks like the V bar I term should cancel.
V bar, no, there are three of them, right? There is one with minus and there are two with plus. So you have two minus
one. One in the bottom looks different though, because the bar is on, it's the same thing?
But the indices are, one is ij, the other is ji, right? So you can just write b bar j in front and then relabel the indices and you get the same.
So it's the same?
Yeah. There was some other question or? Yeah?
Yeah. Is the unity one also the Grassmann number?
Well, one commutes with everything, right? The number one.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right, so that's a problem with the new variables, B were complex. Because then we add a number, and then we're not inside the algebra anymore.
Well, one would commute, but I mean, the rest would still not commute. Theta doesn't commute, so eta is not going to commute either.
No, but I just mean, so with. That is why B has to be a Grassmann number, not a normal number. But if you're a normal number, you're leaving your algebra because you're
but
it's not inside the algebra.
Let's see, if I have theta 1 equals eta 1 plus some constant, and theta 2 equals eta 2 plus, well, some other constant. I mean, when I anti-commute those, the constants are just going to drop out. Right? So theta 1, theta 2, is going to be, so if you substitute in this relation, these are just going to drop out because you'll have.
Wait, are the numbers or are the Grassmann numbers?
Well, the etas are going to remain. So you're still going to have this. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. I have to think about this. Okay, so I'll get back to this tomorrow. So anyhow, but other than this, cleaning up this issue, tomorrow we're going to start considering calculus of variations and functional derivatives. So that's all for today.